Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I got the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Hey, I'm Ben Rhodes, and you are listening to Crooked Conversations. I recently published a book called The World As It Is about my time in the Obama White House. I was there for all 8 years, and on this series of Crooked Conversations, I wanted to take a deeper dive and look at the backstory to some of the issues that I deal with in my book. And I have been very lucky to be joined by some of the people who were there with me over the course of that time in the Obama White House. So over these episodes, we've heard about what it was like to write speeches for President Obama. We've looked at the Russian intervention in the 2016 election, and we will also be looking at Benghazi and how the constellation of Republican politics and right-wing media ultimately helped lead to Donald Trump and the world that we're living in today. But today we're going to cover the U.S. approach to negotiating with Cuba and the historic normalization between the United States and Cuba and our relations, and President Obama's historic 2016 trip to Havana. I'm here with Bernadette Meehan, and this is very exciting to me because Bernadette was closer to me than anybody else who I worked with in the White House. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. Okay, so I'm here with Bernadette Meehan. This is very exciting to me. Hi, Bernadette.
Hi, Ben.
We've been talking about different pieces of the Obama White House, my own experience, some things in my book, and obviously one of the main issues that I focused on was Cuba, but also one of the main people that I worked with was Bernadette Meehan in different roles, which we'll get to here. And Bernadette ended up being essentially the person who played the critical role in helping to organize President Obama's trip to Havana in March of 2016. So that's obviously the main thing we'll focus on here. But I thought just to give people context, Bern, why don't you just start by describing, like, you were on Wall Street, right?
I started my career on Wall Street, that's right, working in foreign exchange trading for J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
And I loved it, but just didn't feel the passion. I couldn't imagine waking up every single day and doing that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So sought a different path and found my way into the Foreign Service, which was the absolute right place for me.
And what year was that?
So this was in 2004 that I joined the Foreign Service.
So you're kind of like in that post 9/11 generation, met a lot of people kind of your age who came into the Foreign Service after 9/11.
Yep.
You were in a bunch of different places, right?
Yep. I served in Colombia for 2 years. I volunteered to go to Baghdad in 2006 during the height of the surge. Studied Arabic for a year and then spent 2 years in Dubai in the Persian Gulf after that before I came back to Washington.
So this is kind of like, you know, Americans don't see what Foreign Service officers do, but they do a lot. And they get to a lot of places. And I guess the quick question is, did you have a favorite? Like, I never even asked you that. Like,
ooh,
of all the places you were posted?
You know, they're all so different, which is the beauty of
it's
the
like
Foreign
choosing
Service.
Choosing between your children.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It's choosing between your children. I mean, they all are – they're all different. I mean, Colombia is just vibrant and warm, and Colombians love family and music and eating and dancing.
Yeah.
Baghdad obviously was a completely different situation, but the Iraqi people are smart and resilient and incredible, and it was a good experience there under really difficult conditions. And Dubai is sort of a city that glitters. It's sort of everything you'd imagine it would be and beyond. So a really unique experience in a difficult neighborhood of the world.
Yeah, that you wouldn't expect to have this
gleaming
city. Okay, so you go to the State Department then. You work for Hillary Clinton. And then you came over to work on the NSC, the National Security Council, as a spokeswoman in 2012.
Yes.
And ultimately became the spokesperson for the National Security Council. So kind of my right-hand woman and to the listeners of the pod, successor to Tommy Vitor.
That's
so
right.
An illustrious legacy of
yep.
people here. Now, I obviously was also doing these secret negotiations with Cuba. Do you remember – I'm trying to remember when I brought you into that. And the key point here is that you had to plan the announcement. You know, we were going to pop up on December 17, 2014 and announce to the world that we were normalizing relations with Cuba. And you had the strange job of planning a public rollout of something that was secret.
Yes.
That not many people read into. So like, what do you remember about getting read into that, getting your mind around it, and like planning this announcement that you knew was going to shock people?
Yeah. So I remember you and Ricardo Zuniga, who was your partner in the negotiations, bringing me into a conference room and saying that you were doing something really that was going to shake up the game on Cuba. And I remember the two of you sitting down and sort of walking me through the parameters of what you were working on. And it was one of those few experiences you have in life where you feel like your mind is really, truly blown. And the funny thing is, I remember in the lead up and the planning of how we were going to do this rollout and finalize the negotiations, being one of the few people who knew when you were traveling. And at the same time, we were dealing with some issues related to the Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah.
And I remember one day being in the bathroom.
Oh, God, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Really freaked out about something that had happened with the Iran deal. And you called me with a really bad phone connection because you were doing these secret negotiations and nobody else really knew where you were.
Yeah.
And I was one of the few, and having to sort of dance around when people would say, well, where is Ben to weigh in on this? And I would say, well, you know, he's with his wife, you know, she's having a baby, Anne's pregnant, or he's not feeling well today, and always having to make up some reason why you weren't there. When
I didn't make it easier for you too, because I didn't tell anybody, I didn't make up excuses, I just kind of didn't come to work.
That's right. It was just the where's Ben game, which was a common game in the West Wing at the time. So I remember you guys bringing me into this, and you're right, you know, the challenge was, how do you plan for something that if anything gets out before we're ready to announce it, it could threaten the entire thing. And you know, the premium at the time really being on the safety of Alan Gross and making sure that he was released safely and everything else sort of being gravy on top.
Yeah. Yeah. And because we had this intricate, you know, sequence where, you know, Alan Gross, the USAID contractor, was in prison in Cuba. And there was also an intelligence asset of the United States that we would need to get out of Cuba. We're going to be picked up on separate planes.
That's right.
In exchange for three Cubans that we were releasing from prison.
Yeah.
And then Obama and Castro are going to announce this jointly, I mean separately, but at the same time. And then fact sheets are going to go out and briefings are going to be done to the Congress and the press. And you came up with a code name. Was that your idea?
It was. So we needed a way to be able to communicate with the very small group across the State Department, Treasury, the intelligence community, and the White House. And there were times when we needed to communicate about unclassified matters related to this, but we didn't want it to sort of be something that someone could find out if they were monitoring email. So we called it Project Ardilla. Ardilla is the Spanish word for squirrel. And it was in honor of the Hanna-Barbera cartoon character, Secret Squirrel.
Yes,
going way, way back.
Squirrel enterprise. Yeah.
So he was our secret squirrel. Project Ardilla is how we referred to it. And that's when people knew, you know, check your classified system for an update, or we need to get together in person to discuss something about Cuba, essentially.
So we had, you know, a year and a half of these secret negotiations, as I described in the book, and some of you guys have heard me talk about. And it was me and Ricardo Zuniga on the American side, who's just like the greatest guy in the history of people, and the best Cuba expert in the U.S. government. And then Alejandro Castro, Raul Castro's son, was the interlocutor on the Cuban side. We make the announcement. The rollout was brilliantly planned, of course, and by Bernadette. And then we get all this momentum for U.S.-Cuba relations. What was strange to me is that even as the State Department then gets involved in setting up an embassy, Alejandro very much still wanted to talk to the White House.
That's right.
He liked having this White House channel. So I kept traveling down to Havana. Ricardo moved on, and so I kind of didn't have the same team. And we knew that the big thing we could do is have Obama go and be the first U.S. president to go since the Cuban Revolution, that would be the transformative event.
It's incredible, Anne-Marie, to think about this, that the last U.S. president to visit Cuba was Calvin Coolidge.
I know.
88 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, I don't think for a lot of people this has sunk in how historic of a moment this is for a United States president to be there in Cuba.
So you left in for a time in
2015. In June.
You got married and like thought you were getting out. It was like,
that's right.
But I pulled you back in.
Like Michael Corleone.
Yes,
I thought I was escaping, but I couldn't get out.
Because I basically put together this pickup team to run the Obama trip. We knew the secret is, frankly, that Obama wanted to go in March because that was his kid's spring break and he wanted to take his kids. So we kind of knew we had to hit the target of March. So I brought you back to basically run the trip planning,
When do you remember exactly when you...
So I remember exactly. I had just gotten engaged on Christmas Day, and you called me on New Year's Eve. You were in Hawaii with the president and your family.
Oh, that's right.
And I got this phone call. My fiancé, Evan, was in the shower, and you called, and it was like this awkward, stilted conversation where you were like, hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, it's New Year's Eve. Well, what's going on with you?
Yeah.
And you sort of, you know, asked me about the engagement. We talked for a few minutes. I just said, well, why are you calling me on New Year's Eve?
Yeah.
And you said, look, Obama's going to go to Cuba. We're going to do this.
Yeah.
Will you come back and help organize the trip? And how could I say no at that point?
I forgot. I remember I was walking on the beach in Hawaii.
Yep.
It seems great when you go to Hawaii, but nobody else goes. So, like, you know, you're like all by yourself.
Right. And you're New working.
Year's Eve. You're working. So I'm calling you and you probably don't even know it's New Year's. I probably didn't even know it was New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
So the theory of this trip was to basically cover everything from how do we get as much policy done as we can, how do we make as many changes in the U.S. government as we can to our Cuba policy to open things up, symbolically, like what are the things that we can do to show that, you know, this is a new relationship and to kind of build goodwill with the Cuban people, how do we bring in the Cuban American community that obviously has very passionate feelings about Cuba. How do we, you know, lift up cultural touchstones like baseball?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, what was your, like, when you sat down, you're trying to get your mind around how did you think through this trip? Like, how did you try to organize that? We wanted to get American businesses in.
I mean, this was probably one of the most daunting things I've worked on in the U.S. government. You know, Cuba as a whole, but this trip, even just a microcosm of that. I mean, as you said, there are so many touchstones. The expectations are so high.
Yeah.
He was the first sitting president in something like 88 years. I think it was Coolidge or someone
Coolidge,
like that
yeah.
who was the last one to go. And you're also dealing with planning a presidential trip with spotty communications, lack of internet service in many places on the island, and a host government that has very rigid ideas about what they see to be a successful trip that don't necessarily mesh with what our ideas are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you really felt like you were carrying the weight of something really historical and enormous on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And you know me, I also get nervous and I'm very high anxiety and high stress. So it was, wow, there's so many moving parts. How do we do this in the way that really lives up to what's expected of us?
Yeah, no, so we had a great team. And,
we had a great team. Siobhan Shields
deserves special kudos. But number one, we change as much of our policy as we can. So we basically make it as easy as possible for Americans to travel there.
Yep.
We make it much easier for certain types of business transactions to take place.
Cigars and alcohol.
Cigars and alcohol, people can buy as much of that and bring it back as they want, which is obviously very popular. We set up direct mail service resumes.
Yep.
So we're doing all this. We're trying to get U.S. businesses into Cuba and get the Cubans to sign business deals. And then we're building a trip itself. And we're trying to get the Cubans to do some things as well, like get rid of
the tax.
They had this tax where if you use a dollar, essentially,
that's right.
We're 10%
surcharge.
And obviously want them to extend internet access. Yeah. And actually, this was really hard because the Cubans never wanted to look like they're doing something that we're pressuring them to do.
That's right.
So, like, for instance, they would extend internet access without telling us they were doing it in advance.
Right.
Suddenly we just see some news story that, like, some Wi-Fi hotspot.
But so it doesn't seem like it's in response to our pressure.
Which was too bad because we would have liked to have taken credit. just a couple of things before we get to the trip itself. I mean, one is I remember we went to Miami to basically have a listening session with Cuban Americans.
That's right.
I remember knowing this was going to be intense when I met at the gate by a police escort.
That's right, at the airport.
Yeah, that's driving me in like golf carts, and they were there.
Through the airport.
Men in earpieces all day.
Yep.
And, you know, it's a sign that like people in Miami, some people were not very happy about what we were doing.
Yep.
What was your, like, how do you describe to like a layperson that community and like how they were invested in the Cuba issue and what your impressions of them were?
I would say, I mean, they really served as like a kitchen cabinet. You know, they were as much as an advisory council to us as any of the experts in the U.S. government, because you can be an expert in the policy, you can be an expert in the history, but, you know, unless you're a Cuban American or a Cuban, you don't have the passion, right?
Yeah.
You don't have the personal historical ties to what's going on there. You don't have the feeling of being separate separated from family or having family on different sides of the issue of is, you know, restoring diplomatic ties a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, there's so much tied up in that that no matter how much you study it or how much you're ingrained in it, you don't feel the passion like they do.
Yeah.
And I think you would agree that, you know, our kitchen cabinet in Miami is a passionate group.
Yes.
Above all else, very opinionated, yeah. Not shy to tell us what they really think. And that's why they were so valuable. And I think they had great ideas. And we saw this in language you used in the speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
In
yeah.
some of the groups and organizations that we met with down there, that they had really wonderful ideas and frankly, I think made us and our policy all the better for their input. I don't think we could have done this without them.
So then before we get into the trip itself, you have to go down to kind of start to lay the groundwork here.
Yes.
And I think at the end we should probably come back and kind of compare the North Korea stuff that just happened with what we did here. But so you have to go down there. Now, I've been negotiating with Alejandro, but people, you hadn't met him.
Mm-hmm.
Alejandro's Raul's son. He was widely seen as like one of the most powerful people in Cuba, if not kind of the second most powerful man. He's a big guy. There was a rumor that he lost an eye
in
Angola, which
yes.
is such a Cuban thing, right?
Yes.
And kind of gregarious. But mysterious to a lot of Americans. He never came to the United States mm-hmm. until, you know, after obviously December 17th.
Intimidating.
So you get down there. But he has this lovely translator, by the way, who was Fidel Castro's translator too,
yep.
Juanita.
Yep.
What happens when you get down there?
Well, first of all, I mean, you can imagine the excitement on the plane. We're on a U.S. government sort of branded plane.
Yeah.
And when you're pulling into Havana in a U.S. government plane, you just think, wow, like
yeah.
this is real and this is really changing. Like we're open about it. We're flying
yeah.
in. This is really incredible. As you would imagine, the Cubans were sort of very rigid with the protocol.
Yeah.
Lots of security around. I think there was a formidable task in getting the teams to trust each other.
You
know, you and Alejandro and Ricardo and Alejandro's team, Juanita among them, had this bond. But for the rest of us, it was all sort of.
Yeah.
Okay, our bosses all say we have to trust each other and make this work. How do we exactly go about that? But we hit the ground running. I think the most difficult thing was, as I said before, you know, the Cubans had very different ideas of what would make a successful trip.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of negotiating about how they would spend their time in terms of optics and
their ideas
symbols.
Were basically like we would go to government facilities and
correct.
We'll
like,
at,
we will,
like
we will
we'll
take
look at
you
their
to
showcase,
yeah.
you know, yeah,
you know
yeah,
they're
yeah.
very proud of their education
yeah,
system,
yeah.
their medical research, their all of that. And so the idea was we will take you to, you know, a medical facility and we will have a scientist who's brilliant, you know, give you a talk
yeah,
or a lecture.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
we sort of said, well, we're not really sure that will resonate
yeah.
as much. So it was definitely a negotiation, I would say.
And by the way, they distrust the United States that has tried to invade them.
Yes.
And when the U.S. president goes someplace, we basically invade the country.
That's
like
right.
1,000 security people
That's
go.
Right.
We're flying in guns and
That's
cars.
Right. Yep.
So that,
absolutely.
That
so
was a little
they
difficult.
They had
well.
A lot to deal
yeah.
with. And, you know, they would say, well, we've had the Pope visit and we've had all these other people visit. And we were just kind of like, oh, my friends, you have no
yeah.
idea what's
yeah.
about to hit you with the president of the United States coming. But I do remember at one point after sort of the big teams were gone, all the logistics folks and the security folks, Alejandro and his team took me and Siobhan and our ambassador at the time, the fantastic Jeff De Laurentiis,
yeah.
Out to dinner to do some sort of policy negotiations. And they took us to, you know, a state-owned restaurant.
Yeah.
It was in this high tower in Havana, and they were, you know, very proud of it. And we were sitting in this room, and they just broke out bottle after bottle
yeah, yeah,
after
yeah.
bottle of rum.
Very good rum. I mean,
right,
this is like the good Havana
amazing
Club.
Amazing rum.
This and is not Captain Morgan.
No, yeah. and you're thinking to yourself, like, is this a ploy
yeah.
to sort of get
yes.
me inebriated
yes,
and not know what I'm talking about? Or are they just like happy to
well,
share their
both.
Rum?
It's both, actually. Like, I found over the years, like, it's a little bit of both. Like, yeah.
I mean, I like to think I did my Irish heritage proud
yes.
by, like, every glass they put in front of me, I would
No, they're
I
very
would
impressed at
them.
You and Siobhan. Like,
we,
you know,
we could
you,
keep up.
Two small women going, you know, drinking.
Yeah. And then, you know, we moved into the formal dinner room. And after dinner, they knew that I had a sweet tooth.
Yeah.
Right. So
See, they do their research.
They
and,
do
yeah.
they do their research. That's for sure. And they have this great meal out in front of us. And then all of a sudden, Alejandro got very excited. It was very sweet. And he said, you know, we have something for you. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get some cigars to
yeah.
take home, you know, for my fiance who loves them, or like
yeah.
a beautiful bottle of rum. And these waiters walk in tuxedos
yeah.
pushing a cart. And on the cart is the biggest ice cream cake you've ever seen that's doused in something that looks like green lighter fluid. And they they roll it over and they light it on fire. So it's like this flaming ice cream cake. And I thought,
just for you.
Just for me. Just for you. This is the kicker. Yeah. I thought, well, this is great for the whole table. And they literally put it just in front of me. And then they say, well, now you need to eat it. And everyone else gets an ice cream sundae in like a tiny little cup. And I'm sitting here with this massive ice cream cake in front of me.
Yeah. It's never dull with the Cubans.
It's never dull with the Cubans. Yeah. And it was actually a very nice gesture, really. And I did not finish it, but it was
if they
was
think
tasty.
You like something, I mean, I remember they used to, I had these meals where they would have the whole roasted pig.
Yes.
And Alejandro, like, first time said, you know, the guest breaks off the skin, this crispy skin of the pig, and eats it. And I ate it, and he said, is it good? I said, yeah, it's really good. And every time
I went
to Cuba ever again, they'd have a pig. Yes. And I'd always have to, like, even if I wasn't hungry.
Yes. You'd have to eat the pig.
I'd have to sit there and just eat with hands the skin of this pig.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yep.
Well, so that, I mean, it was a lot of tension, but like, and everybody stressed out.
Yeah.
We're asking for things they don't want to give.
Correct.
We wanted Obama's speech to be broadcast on television.
That's right.
We wanted this event with entrepreneurs, which is kind of fascinating culturally because they wanted basically Obama to meet their state-owned people. We wanted to meet these hip young Cubans who own restaurants and shops, and you know they're self-employed, and so we had to figure out how to make that work.
Yeah.
We wanted Obama and Castro to take questions at this press conference.
That's right.
So in addition to all these policy things, and what was interesting in retrospect is they did not give a lot on the policy. You know, we wanted to basically reform their whole economy. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to do that. But they ended up giving a lot on this symbolic things, I think because they wanted it to be a good trip. But we did some things before that were interesting. I mean, just to quickly tick through a couple, why don't you – the name Panfilo?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this was Jeff – Ambassador Jeff De Laurentiis' wife had this great idea and she pitched it and through Jeff. And I remember him emailing me and he said, look – I bet the president will never do this, but I feel like I need to put it forward. And Panfilo, who's this well-known Cuban comedian who impersonates like this really old guy who plays dominoes with his friends. He's actually a young guy. He said, why don't you do a phone call with him or some interaction with him?
Ay, madre, no lo puedo creer. Me salió la Casa Blanca Real. ¿Usted pudiera mandarle un mensaje al presidente Obama? ¿Se lo puede dar?
This is President Obama.
Para que conozca Cuba, para que conozca su gente.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. The American people and the Cuban people are friends.
So I remember talking to you about it and you said, like, this is exactly what we need.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about people-to-people ties and showing that, you know, it's not just about governments interacting.
Yeah.
And I remember Obama and Panfilo filmed a phone call in advance. And then when we were down there, they built an entire replica of the set in the back of a brewery where we were doing this entrepreneurial event. And we recorded this and it went viral. It was one of these, like, amazing videos that just sort of seared across the island, and people were so excited about it.
Obama, Obama, qué bueno que viniste a conocer La Habana. Obama, Obama, so nice you came to Havana.
That's a beautiful song. Thank you so much. You guys are playing dominoes. You know, I've always wanted to learn how to play dominoes.
And more people came up to me. I mean, it's important, like, honestly, like, more Cubans came up to me and were like, oh, I saw Panfilo.
It's so great.
You forget in government that gestures like that,
yes,
like they really reach people.
Yep.
They make people feel like you respect their culture.
That's
you know
right.
who they are. You know, Panfilo was a little edgy, too, for Cuba.
Yes.
Like, he made jokes about ration cards and
yep.
stuff. And you know, I wish we had more of that today, like
yeah.
that reach out. But so I remember, like, the run-up, though, like, we have all the announcement, the policy changes. We had this Panfilo thing.
And the other good thing about Panfilo was getting to watch President Obama read cue cards in
yes.
Spanish
oh,
with his gringo accent.
Yeah, sitting. He thinks he speaks better Spanish than he does.
Yeah, it was a little raw, but it was a lot of fun.
that almost gives you more points for trying.
Yes, that's right.
We had the first letter. We restarted direct mail service. And
the
first letter was President Obama responding to some elderly Cuban woman who wrote him a letter saying
right.
she never thought this would happen.
That's
and
right.
so there was a lot of good feeling kind of by the time the plane took off to get down there. I remember flying down, and it's very powerful when you like fly into Cuba because you fly over Miami, which is like one of the most distinctive cities in the world because you can see South Beach and you can see all these massive
bright
developments
and
bright lights and the beach.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, within like minutes, because it's only 90 miles, this very undeveloped, not even under, like undeveloped island just emerges.
Yeah.
And you see the contrast of essentially the most first world place, Miami, and then this island has been frozen in time by a mixture of our embargo and, you know, their system. And Obama looks out the window and he says to me, he's like, that doesn't look like a threat to the national security of the United States, which is basically like how we've justified this policy for decades.
Mm-hmm.
We land and it's raining.
Pouring rain.
You must have been so stressed out because you're trying to make everything go perfect.
So stressed out. And if you remember, you know, you and Siobhan and I were down there to do some last minute negotiations. And you and Siobhan flew back to come back down with the president.
Yeah.
And Siobhan has this great picture where we're, you know, the plane was a very small government plane, not a branded plane, right?
Yeah.
A small one that was sort of landed on this dirt airstrip because it was a very low key sort of not secret, but, you know, sort of confidential visit. And Siobhan has this great picture that she took from the window of the plane where you guys are taking off back to America.
She's leaving you there.
And you're leaving me there to finish up the negotiations.
Yeah.
And it's me, Alejandro, Juanita, and the other two Cuban guys.
Yeah.
And I just have this look on my face like,
can I come?
Shoot.
Well, and you can vouch. That was a really crazy trip, like where I got pulled into some 3-hour meeting with Raul Castro.
That's right.
Where he went off about all manner of things, you know, an Italian businessman that he let live on a small island to feed sharks off the coast of Cuba and pounded the table and said, you know, we Cubans don't want your candy, you know, you Americans. And so, you know, it was edgy too. But we get down there, it's raining. But like there was also just this great feel like Rachel, you guys had set it up so remarkably that like we're traveling down there. We've got members of Congress with us. We have Cuban Americans with us. We had Jackie Robinson's widow with us.
And daughter.
And daughter.
Yep.
Jimmy Buffett was down there. Like
Derek
people
Jeter,
just turned up on there. Derek
Jose
Jeter.
Andres.
So yeah, we set the baseball, this Major League Baseball game that we'll get to. So it also felt though like this cast of American characters was like descending on Cuba.
Yeah. You know? But everyone who had a stake in it. You know,
emotional,
who really had an emotional stake in what was happening.
Jackie Robinson had played in Havana, so that's why his widow is coming.
I'm Ben Rhodes, and we will be back with more of my conversation with Bernadette Meehan after this break. No matter who you are, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day to stay healthy. You know that. Quip knows that. And their team of dentists and designers is focused on helping you take care of your mouth much better. Quip's subscription model is a thoughtful, inexpensive solution for people who want to make it easy to keep up with the simple habits that will improve your oral health, make you much more pleasant to be around, make your loved ones' lives that much better. Let Quip do the thinking for you when it comes to your teeth. Who wants to think about their teeth? Let Quip do that thinking for you. So let me just tell you what makes Quip so different. For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes, with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping, worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And I hope you take your teeth wherever you go. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association, the people who you should be listening to, even more than me. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/crookedconvos right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/crookedconvos, spelled getquip.com/crookedconvos.
So we go through the first day, which is Obama touring Old Havana. He sees the cardinal who helped orchestrate the Vatican role in the, our negotiations with Cuba.
He's with Mrs. Obama and the girls.
He's with the Mrs. Obama and the girls, which is not normal.
Yeah.
So I remember there was some relief that first day, this is actually happening. That night we all go to a Paladar, which are, for people who don't know, it's like there's state-owned restaurants, and then there's basically people take their homes and turn them into restaurants and cook for you.
Yeah. And we went to La Guarida.
Yeah, how did you find that anyway? Like,
so it's a well-known Paladar there. I think most visitors probably make a stop there at some point. But it has, aside from phenomenal food, a great bar and this incredible roof deck, right?
Yeah,
and you
yeah.
go in through this old building and there's murals on the wall. And it's just this incredibly Cuban, authentic Cuban feeling place.
Yeah.
And you have this great roof deck and people are smoking cigars and drinking rum. And it's very hip, but also very old world at the same time.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like the perfect place for such a random mix of characters to actually convene and sort of celebrate the start of this historic trip.
Yeah.
And you're right. You know, you sort of look over and you're like, well, there's Jimmy Buffett talking to Derek Jeter, who's talking to the Cuban chef, who's talking to, you know, this young hip Cuban designer.
Yeah. It felt like this is like a good thing that's happened. I mean, I remember also like Jose Andreas like chest bumping me and telling us what to order, and
it was
a great vibe.
Yep.
Some Cuban hip hop guy smoking cigars.
That's right. Yotuel.
Susan Rice.
From the Orishas.
So the next day though, we like things get interesting. So we had negotiated very like insistently that they take questions. Mm-hmm. And I think it is important to note
at the press conference.
Yeah. Why was that important? Why was it important for Raul Castro to take questions with Barack Obama after their press conference?
Well, I think, you know, we've always made a point in all of our trips, including China, which was probably the only other one that was
really
as
hard,
sort of difficult as this to really negotiate, to say, you know, we believe and we support in a free press. You know, the press has a vibrant and important role to play in any democracy. Cuba, of course, is not a democracy like the U.S., but it's important to sort of stay true to our values even when we're going to places that we don't necessarily agree with the government and all that the government does. And when President Obama travels abroad and takes a press conference, he answers questions from people.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what resonated in one way, because I know you and I both spent a lot of time talking to Alejandro and talking to these guys about this, is that it, even at a minimum, would have looked awkward for President Castro. You know, there's all this attention of the world, but also his own people on this. You know, you don't want to seem like you're afraid to answer a question. And it's this historic moment. And why would you risk sort of spoiling it and making that the story that you're afraid to take a question? And so I think it was critically important. And I think, you know, the world was watching, and I think our press appreciated what we did. And, you know, Jim Acosta, who takes a lot of heat these days, who, you know, is of Cuban descent, got to ask a question, you know, at this historic press conference. And I think that, again, was another layer of sort of symbolism and a connection and the passion and the connection that people have to Cuba.
And Cubans have never seen their president take
questions,
right?
Yeah.
And have to, and then adversarial questions. Jim Acosta asked him about political prisoners, you know, and then Andrea Mitchell asked a question. And so this is, I remember just feeling like I'd never been on a trip where everything that happened was historic. Like
that's
it was
right.
historic.
Every little thing to
when
us.
Obama landed, it was historic when he stood in Revolutionary Square with like the image of Che there.
Yep.
And they played the Cuban and American national anthems. It was historic when Raul Castro took questions.
Yeah.
And there was this kind of bizarre scene where he didn't hear the question. And then he kind of yelled at Jim Acosta and said, "We have no political prisoners.
Right.
Give me the list." And
that's right.
But it was, the Cubans, like I said, had not seen their present, you know, challenge like this.
Yeah.
And so then after the press conference, which, you know, would have been enough for one day.
Right. And ended with that awkward sort of.
Yeah. Castro tried to kind of hold his hand in triumph with Obama.
That's right.
And you're always worried about like, and this is actually anticipates the North Korea thing.
Yes.
You don't want to be too close to someone who's, you know, let's face it, a dictator.
That's right.
And so Obama's wary of that being the picture on all of Cuban media. So he kind of, his hand was a little limp.
Because optics matter, right?
Yeah,
you're passing
we're
a message.
Engaging them, but we're not saying everything you do is okay.
We're not endorsing everything.
Which Trump did with Kim Jong-un, obviously.
Right.
Now, the next piece of this, and what's interesting about this trip is the trip itself kind of was meant to be emblematic of our policy, right? So first we're engaging the government because we're building this relationship, putting the Cold War in the past, setting up bilateral agreements and cooperation on things, showing the world that we can move past this. Then the next event was with these entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. because a big part of our policy was Cuba used to be entirely communist. They opened up their economy so that some of these people could have their own businesses, mm-hmm. you know, again, shops, taxis, restaurants. Because of the opening where we could let in all this money from the U.S., you know, yeah. remittances from Cuban Americans and travelers, the number of Cubans who are self-employed went from like 10% to almost like a third, I think. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to showcase this sector of the Cuban economy. Mm-hmm. And so why don't you describe that event? Because that event was pretty remarkable, too.
That event was, that was
remarkable.
May have
been actually the best, most unique event.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably right. And it required an extraordinary amount of behind-the-scenes maneuvering for what may have looked like a pretty run-of-the-mill sort of run of show. But you're right. I mean, the Cubans had always seen the state-run enterprises as sort of the backbone of their economy. And while they had opened up space for these cuentapropistos, they were certainly wary of them and didn't want to be highlighting them. And we argued back and forth for weeks and weeks and weeks about who would be allowed to attend, who would speak at the event, how it would run, what they were allowed to say. And, you know, we said, look, for us, it's about entrepreneurship. And they said, for us, it's about state-owned enterprises. And I think this is one of the places where, you know, we compromised. And I think people like me who maybe take a harder line sometimes thought, well, we're caving in and this is like a bad thing and this doesn't represent what we're all about. But the reality is, and I think you were the one who said this, after the event was over and Soledad O'Brien was the moderator, and you had these cuentapropistos who had to get up and talk about their businesses, and you had some state-owned enterprise folks who got up and spoke about their businesses. And someone said, this is probably the first time they had to be in a room together. Yeah. And these members of the government were forced to listen to these young people who were running their own businesses. And we have to look at it as that in itself is a breakthrough and an accomplishment and an important movement forward, even if it's not exactly how we planned. And I think that's right, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to a great journalist, John Lee Anderson, after, who also said one of the most powerful moments to him was Brian Chesky gets up, the CEO mm-hmm. of Airbnb. We brought him too. It was just a cast of thousands. And he talks to Obama, and Obama asked him, like, Brian, how old are you? And he said, I don't know, 29 or whatever he is. And Obama's like, and how much is your company worth? And it's like X billion dollars.
Yep.
And John Lee said that was actually one of the most powerful things on the island, because, like, that's what capitalism can do, you know,
right.
like the Cuban young people, and there are a lot of them, you know, for them to see someone their age who's able to just have an idea and make a business, you know, that was incredibly provocative in a way to showcase capitalism in the heart of Havana like that.
Yeah.
Even if we didn't intend it that way, I mean,
candidly,
like we weren't thinking that much about, you know, what Brian Chesky's president would say. But we were thinking about if you could showcase these entrepreneurs and get them in the room. Ultimately, when we had cooperatives and state-owned people, it did create a dialogue that never happened before in Cuba.
That's right, which is progress in its own right.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sarah Heck, who helped work with the entrepreneurs, and Duncan Teeter, who, of course, is one
Duncan
of our
Teeter,
favorite
yes.
advance guys,
the
who
very best.
I remember, you know, Duncan Teeter, the day before I think the president landed, you know, had his own frustrations working on the logistics, you know, with the Cubans. I mean, sort of banging his head against the wall and thinking, oh, God, this is so difficult. Sent a text message to those of us that were on the ground, and it had a photo he had taken on his iPhone of a bunch of Cuban workers who were sort of building out the stage and the set, sitting there staring at, they had a massive American flag, you know, hanging down from the rafters next to a massive Cuban flag.
Yeah.
And all of these Cubans were just sitting there looking at it. And he took this snapshot, you know, just sort of run of the mill on his iPhone and sent it. And it was this incredibly powerful image of just, what are we doing here? You know, when's the last time anyone has seen those two flags hanging
together,
next to each other?
Yeah.
Certainly not, you know, the Cubans in the room or any of us who are, you know, young and working on this trip. And it was those little moments behind the scenes, I think, also that reminded you of the importance of what we were doing, even if not everything was exactly as we would have wanted it or how the Cubans would have wanted
it. Yeah, it took on its own chemistry in a way. I remember that was like one of the most powerful.
It was very poignant.
Yeah, because you're just haggling and then you see that and you know that that's going to have an impact on people.
That's right. There's a breakthrough
that you don't even know.
Unintended.
Yeah, you don't even know what the impact is going to be. So then I think there was like a state dinner I remember going to, which was kind of interesting because you had Cuban Americans in the room with Cubans and, you know, prominent people and left-wing people but others. But then I had to go to Obama's, where he was staying at Jeff De Laurentiis's, again, amazing, amazing ambassador for the U.S. You went to this Major League Baseball party.
I did.
If one piece was engaging the government and one piece was engaging the economy, Another was culture, and MLB was going to be a big piece of that.
Yep.
What happened at that party
So this was an epic party for the ages. And yeah. I should say, you know, the MLB team was phenomenal to work with.
They were great, yeah.
And when I went down on the original sort of scoping trip, and they took me to see this stadium, the baseball stadium, and I just thought, oh my God, there is zero chance we can have this ready in 6 weeks. I mean, they had to bring in an engineer to level the actual literal playing field.
Yeah.
The seats were crumbling. I mean, there was like holes in the roof. And I thought, first of all, Secret Service is never going to approve this. Second of all, like, how are these people going to play baseball out
yeah.
here? But the MLB team, you know, in conjunction with the Cuban team, really, you know, did an amazing job.
Up,
they
yeah.
fixed it up. And so they threw this big celebratory party in this old castle in part of Havana. And it really was a collection of sort of all of these amazing people that we were
yeah.
talking about. I mean, they had a guy rolling cigars. They had all of these classic cars lining the roadway up. They had a back room where Penny Pritzker was talking to Derek Jeter, who was talking to—
You're a Yankee fan, so you're—
I'm a Yankee fan, so I was like totally yeah. excited about that. And then all of a sudden, the best part of it was everyone sort of drinking and enjoying themselves and, you know, in a really good mood about what's happening. And then you just hear like Margaritaville.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Buffett's just up on stage giving an impromptu
Jimmy
concert.
Buffett loves Cuba. Like, he
loves
told me
Cuba.
This. Yeah, I mean, he's always—
And he did this full-on concert.
He wanted to sing the national anthem.
He wanted to sing the national
yeah.
anthem. And you had Cubans and Americans just enjoying in this. You can imagine, like, the perfect Havana night, this
yeah.
balmy air.
Oh, man, sounds
You know,
good.
You're, like, in this beautiful old location. Jimmy Buffett's singing.
Yeah.
You know, people are talking about baseball, cigars, rum. It just was— It was a moment of levity,
yeah,
and it was a pretty incredible experience.
Yeah, no,
it's very surreal.
But then I remember you guys came back to the hotel where I was working on the speech Obama's giving the next day. So the next day, Obama's going to address the Cuban people, and they're going to broadcast this live on television. To their credit, you
Absolutely.
Know, they said uncensored.
Yep. Didn't see the speech in advance.
Didn't see the speech in advance, and. And so we had this clean shot to do what no American president had ever been able to do, talk to the Cuban people. And so this was the centerpiece of the trip. And that's what everybody had told us. The policies actually don't matter as much as the speech in
yeah.
a way. And so that night I remember you and Ricardo, who we basically just made
Yanked
come on
bed.
This trip, even though he wasn't.
Oh, yeah, because
yeah,
he was in Brazil.
Yeah, he was in Brazil.
That's right.
And Shaban come to my room. And I just remember it was as good a moment as I have in government, because it's like the trip's going well.
Mm-hmm.
People are excited. The speech is the next day.
The baseball game.
I think we had some rum out. Baseball game, and then just reading the speech, which was this kind of statement of our beliefs about you know, the history that led us here, that you can put the past behind you. You know, the Cuba policy, I always like to say, is about more than Cuba. It was about, like, you know, if we can work this out, like, maybe the rest of the world can. You know. But also the Cuban people are so wonderful, and like just trying to offer them some hope that like things could get better here.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're starting to get rid of this crazy policy. We're starting to open up. Your life can get better. Yes, and we're going to defend our values, our commitment to democracy and human rights here. But we're not going to, you know, we're not going to do that in a manner that punishes you,
mm-hmm.
the Cuban people.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice night, I remember. Now, the next day, you had actually worked hard to make sure we could get some people at the speech. You know,
That's
sometimes
right.
it's like who controls who's in the
yeah,
crowd.
The tickets
we wanted to have some people in the audience that would be symbolic,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and we did a lot of negotiations, even on the venue. I mean, when we went down there on the scoping trip, you know, the Cubans wanted us to do it at universities
yeah.
and these auditoriums. And, you know, then you have to ask the question, well, this university isn't ideologically aligned with sort of the values
yeah.
of the U.S. That doesn't work. You want it, knowing that it's a historic event, to be sort of a grand venue that fits mm-hmm. the moment. And we found, you know, there are Capitol Building, which is modeled after our Congress,
yeah.
Was under construction. So we ended up going to one of their, you know, ballet theaters, and it was one of the most spectacular buildings I've ever seen. And we walked in, and we thought immediately, as long as the logistics people in Secret Service are fine with this, this is the place. This is where we're going to have this moment.
Yeah.
And we, again, you know, sort of argued a lot with the Cubans about who would have access to the speech. They wanted to fill it with all sort of government ministers, and we insisted on having some young people. They brought in some American students who were studying medicine at one of the Cuban universities as sort of a show of goodwill to say, here's some young people we think would be excited to see their own president. They're down here studying. So they really tried to meet us halfway. And I remember going into the theater, and we, of course, were seated on the side and sort of reserved seating, and you and Ricardo were making last minute – you were making last minute edits to the speech, and you had said to Ricardo, why don't you come back and prep the boss on pronunciation.
Yeah.
And Ricardo was very seriously writing out how to pronounce, you know, phonetically the Spanish. And Siobhan and I were sitting there, and I remember two things. One is Duncan Teeter, the logistics guy, the site advance guy, you know, surveying the site from one of the balconies, making sure that everything was in order. And then I remember as the crowd filled in, before Raul Castro came, there is this beautiful prima ballerina, Alicia Alonso, who, you know, is quite advanced in age now, you know, losing her sight, who came out onto the balcony in sort of the president's box, dressed in this stunning gown with a turban on. And when she walked out, it literally captivated the entire audience.
Yeah,
you know, she's well known around the world, but she did this graceful maneuver where she lifted up her arms and there was sort of a sash flowing from her arms to acknowledge the crowd. And you just thought, like, wow, this is a moment that you would see in a movie.
And that, like, you know, this is bigger than politics. You know, like, she's probably beloved by people of different ideological views.
Absolutely.
I mean, it just reminded you that how stupid and artificial this conflict is between the United States and Cuba.
And so that sort of set the scene. And then, of course, you know, President Castro came. And and I remember thinking to myself, you know, he obviously had the earphones in for the translation. Like, that's a big thing and no easy thing for him to do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he sat there and, not having seen the speech in advance, obviously, because we don't share the speeches, had to see it and know that everyone was watching his reaction in real time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can agree or disagree with policies, but that to me showed that he was really serious about trying to make a change with whatever space was allowable for him to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell – an important point is that we always think of Cuba and any communist country as like a monolith.
Yeah.
Raul Castro was pushing – like Fidel Castro, definitely much more hardline.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any way that the opening happens if Fidel is president of Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Raul is more pragmatic. He's still communist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's still like
– has his own history.
Has his own history.
Yeah.
But – he's a pragmatist too, and was pushing out ahead of where some of the hardliners were in Cuba. And, you know, he's sitting in the audience, and Obama, you know, pretty robustly defended democracy, called for elections in Cuba, paid tribute to the Cuban Americans who are seen as kind of traitors in Cuba. So it was while also, you know, saying, you know, honoring Cuba's achievements in healthcare and education, you know, we tried to encompass the full history. It's actually like probably my favorite speech because it's just got like the history of the U.S.-Cuba relationship, Latin America, you know, the pros, the cons, here's the statement of belief, the tribute to the Cuban Americans.
One constant was the conflict between the United States and Cuba. I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people. I want to be clear. The differences between our governments over these many years are real, and they are important. I'm sure President Castro would say the same thing. I know, because I've heard him address those differences at length. But before I discuss those issues, we also need to recognize how much we share. Because in many ways, the United States and Cuba are like two brothers who've been estranged for many years, even as we share the same blood.
You know, it may be worth pausing here and just saying, like, by all accounts from people I know and trust who know what they're talking about, there's an analysis that, like, we went too far in that speech, that it prompted a... The irony is that the criticism of us at home was like, oh, you're not beating them over the head on human rights. Mm-hmm. When in fact, the reality is there was a backlash in Cuba from the hardliners. See, you let the Americans come down here. You let Obama go wherever he wanted.
Yep.
You let him give this speech. Mm-hmm. And now we have to clamp down.
It makes it harder for them to have the space.
It makes it harder for them to
push change through.
I mean, what do you think of that? How do you answer that criticism?
It's difficult, right? Because you're right. We do have our values.
Yeah.
We do have these tenets that we hold very dear as Americans, and we I think, at least under President Obama, didn't have a policy of sort of trying to export democracy or, you know, nation build or remold yeah. things. And it was sort of based on respect and finding ways to make progress, no matter how small. And I think you're exactly right. You know, to critics, I would say it doesn't do us any good or our sort of goals any good if we put the people who are going out on a limb within their system into a position where they have to back up and become more hardline.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, it hurts
that's a really good point. Yeah.
Our goals and our objectives. You know, Alejandro, and there were, of course, two other members of the negotiating team that we've, you know, never discussed publicly, and I, you know, won't reveal who they are here, obviously, but they were very different, right? One yeah. was sort of always asking for books on how does the National Security Council yeah, in the U.S.
curious,
work?
Yeah.
Very curious, like, how does your government work? How does, you know, and I have no idea whether that's because, you know, he thought it was a good thing or a bad thing, but he was curious
both,
and wanted
yeah,
to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other who was definitely more of a hardliner.
Yes.
You know, he wrote down every single word that was said in any meeting, and
very
I thought,
stern
gosh,
look on his face.
someday yeah. there's yeah. going to be quite a record of this.
Yeah.
But to their credit, you know, they were also engaged, and there was probably a tension on their team, as there sometimes was in ours, where, you know, someone takes
yeah.
the hardline position, someone
yeah, yeah.
argues as the devil's advocate. And I think, you know, they all went out on a limb within
yeah.
their system. I don't think anyone can argue against that. And for us to do anything that would have jeopardized their ability to do that would have just been shooting
yeah.
ourselves in the foot.
Yeah. No, and they probably will get to, well, and unfortunately, I have to mention Trump, but they probably suffered for it
I'm sure.
when Trump came in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my view of this is like, in particularly complicated moments like that, all you can really do is say what you believe,
yep.
right? And let the chips fall where they may. The theory of our policy was that it's wrong. We should open up. It'll improve the lives of the Cuban people if we open up. And frankly, you know, clearly an embargo and yelling at them wasn't making them a democracy. That, not saying we were going to transform them, but that like openness was more likely to
That's
lead
right.
to liberalization. You
I mean,
know,
we literally achieved no stated U.S. policy goal.
For 60 years.
For 60 years.
And then in the 2 years, more information reached Cubans, more outside ideas reached Cubans,
That's right.
more economic opportunity. You know, people would say, well, it's still a dictatorship. And it's
right.
like, guys, it's been 2 years
That's
here.
Right.
But again, what Obama said is we're not going to tell you who we don't want to pick the next leaders of Cuba.
Right.
And this might take time. And by the way, whatever evolves in Cuba might look different than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, here's what we believe. We believe people should have the right to speech and assembly.
If you were to guess, where would you say your brain stacked up against other people your age? Have you guessed? Well, either way, do you think your memory or your attention, your general outlook is above average? Use Lumosity and find out. Lumosity is the world's most popular brain training program. Even though you can't see the results in the mirror or on a bathroom scale, if you want to keep your brain fit, you've got to treat it like a muscle. Sign up for Lumosity and take the free 10-minute fit test to get your baseline scores on 3 games and see how you stack up against others your age. That is when the training begins. With Lumosity Premium, they will even design a personalized training program from their 60-plus cognitive games and activities to challenge your key abilities like memory, speed, and problem-solving. With every game, Lumosity keeps track of your progress and shows you how you compare worldwide, all around the world here. Don't you want to know how you stack up? Find out right now. Go to lumosity.com/crookedconvos. to sign up for the free fit test, plus a 30% discount off Lumosity Premium. 30%, that's a serious discount. It's spelled L-U-M-O-S-I-T-Y, lumosity.com/crookedconvos, C-O-N-V-O-S, where you can take your free fit test and get 30% off Lumosity Premium. lumosity.com/crookedconvos.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Now, then we went to meet with dissidents at the embassy, which, you know, the Cubans don't usually let people meet with dissidents, or they block them from attending the meeting. Again, to their credit,
they
let everybody come, although they beat up some of them a couple days before. Yeah. So you saw the complexity there of these people, you know, their freedoms are restricted, which you can forget when you're walking in a hold of Anna. That it was interesting to hear the perspective of those dissidents. Most of them supported very much what we were doing, and they believed that, like, just more connection to the outside world was better for them, and could pry things open in Cuba a bit. Yeah. You know, the critics mainly wanted us to just have dissidents more at the center of our policy. I'd candidly say that, you know, that that approach hasn't worked. You know, like the Cuban government is very comfortable just kind of repressing dissidents, right? And Obama actually gave them interesting advice, which is like, don't just be a dissident. Build something in your community, like build, you know, build an organization or be an artist or be a journalist like Yoani Sanchez, who we met. But you did you get to know any of these folks? Or Yoani Sanchez, I remember you particularly were a fan of, who's a journalist.
Yoani, you know, Fortini Medio, which is, you know, one of these publications, you know, that she runs and is involved with, has a great team of people that work with her. Like every great person, right? There's a team behind them and doing great things. And this guy, Alejandro, who works for her.
Not Alejandro Castro.
Not Alejandro Castro. Yes, it must be said. You know, they follow that philosophy, right? It's not about being an agitator for the sake of being an agitator. It's seeing things in your own life that you want to see improved, and doing what you can to try and improve them, not for the sake of agitating or for the sake of being a spoiler, but because you want a better life for yourself, for your kids, for whoever it is, you know, that's important to you. And I think, you know, with that group that we met with, they all had different vehicles. Not all were journalists. Some were true sort of political activists. Some are artists. You know. They each have their own path. And I think one of the things I always appreciated about President Obama is, you know, his sort of broader definition of civil society and who operates in that space that, you know, we've sort of carried forward in other things that we've done for him. And recognizing that you don't have to be sort of a hardcore professional, like, protest marcher to be in the civil society space and make a difference.
An entrepreneur, an artist,
you know, others who have other ways of sort of creating vehicles for free expression and dissent and things like that. And so I think that was one of the values of how we did it. And I think the other thing is, frankly, if you asked almost anyone on the island or back here what resonated, it probably wasn't that meeting, right? It was the baseball game or the speech or seeing him walk through Havana and talk to ordinary Cubans. And I think that's part of the point, right? Of if you put all the pressure on sort of, did you meet with dissidents or did you do this? It's trying to make a point for the sake of making a point without really accomplishing.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, if our whole policy outside of Obama's time has been embargo, support dissidents, the embargo has done nothing to change the government and the support to dissidents has done nothing to help dissidents. There's an absurdity to it. And I always felt like it was kind of this pointless thing where the press would be like, you know, are you going to meet the dissidents? And like the Cuban government actually, that's the first thing they agreed to.
Yeah.
You know, like they weren't that. But again, also worth noting, there are people who are incredibly courageous and do suffer and do.
In Cuba.
And so that's why you have to do it, is because you want to show that they are not alone. And hopefully what we're trying to do, though, is to broaden the aperture of who we engage. So then we go to the baseball game, which is a great way to end it. I mean, just describe, like, that feeling.
I mean, I remember walking into that stadium and you just had thousands of people, Cubans. I mean, it was mostly Cubans, obviously, aside from people who came with us, cheering and like seeing Cubans waving American flags in Havana.
Unbelievable.
You know, it was just, it was mind-blowing. And I remember Obama walking in and people were chanting his name and he was waving to the crowd, and then Castro came in, and of course, you know, having been on the ground 6 weeks earlier, I thought to myself, oh, thank God, like, there's a seat for Obama to sit in, and there's, like, paint, and there were little snack boxes
that
they
had put out.
That's
what you're thinking of. You're not thinking of the feeling. You're thinking of the snack boxes.
Right. I was like, the floor, the playing field looks level, and it looks like no one's going to break their ankle, like, running to first base. And a couple of things stood out. One was seeing the two flags next to each other, you know, at the top of the stadium. The second was when Mrs. Obama and the girls and the president took their seats, you know, next to President Castro. And as you mentioned, you know, Jimmy Buffett had wanted to sing the anthem, and we got a lot of offers for that. And in the end, the Cubans really felt strongly that a Cuban choir sing the anthems.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think that was absolutely the right choice. I mean, hearing a Cuban choir sing both anthems was incredibly moving.
Cubans
and it was
sing the national anthem,
it was respectful,
American national anthem,
you know, of us and sort of a show of friendship. And then each of the teams came, I remember, and handed flowers to Mrs. Obama through the netting behind home plate, which was just this incredible gesture. And then I remember you were running around trying to find someone, and and I were in this VIP section, right? And Alejandro was just sitting next to me, holding his daughter.
Yeah.
He has a
beautiful daughter.
And I thought to myself as I'm looking around, there's so much press here, and there's thousands of Cubans, and he's talking to me out in the open, and what's going on?
Yeah, so it's funny for me because I met Alejandro like 25, 30 times at that point, always like secretly, like jetting off to Canada or Cancun or Trinidad or like, you know, in Havana. And then he sat next to me.
Amazing.
At one point, and I'm like holding his daughter, and like there's 40,000
people. We're waving
here
to his son. He's over in another section.
And the book is actually the first time I've said that Alejandro was my interlocutor, but I was kind of like, well, you know, he seems to not be ashamed, or not ashamed, but like wanting to keep the secret. I was actually negotiating till the very end because the Cubans wanted this photograph.
That's right.
It was interesting.
At the airport, right?
Yeah, Raul's a very family-focused guy. Yeah. Fidel notoriously was not. He had different children and different women in his life.
And Raul had the love of his life he was married to.
Yes, and never remarried. And so he was very important to him that when we got to the airport that they take this family picture together with the Obamas, which was inaudible and
mm-hmm. –
And I remember people thinking, oh, he's going to use this for some propaganda. Mm-hmm. But no, he didn't, actually. It's interesting. I've never seen that picture. I think it was just he's a family guy.
Yeah.
And, so then we leave, and basically everything had gone much better than we thought. There was this amazing feeling that you describe. We had opened things up more in our policy. But above all, like, there was just a sense of like, history happened and it went well.
Yeah.
I guess like one place to begin to wrap up here is, what is it about Cuba? I mean, it's this island of like 11 million people. Why does it occupy this outsized role in the world, in American imagination, in our culture? Like, why is it so important to you? Like, what? Not there's both the meta question and then just you personally. Like, what? Because everybody kind of falls for Cuba in some way. Like, what?
Well, I mean, there's you know, in the broad sense, there's the sexiness of the history, right? There's assassination attempts and, you know, this swarthy guerrilla commander who overthrows, you know, Bautista and takes over. And
Bay of Pigs, missile crisis.
Bay of Pigs and John F. Kennedy, who's, you know, sort of this historical legendary figure in our history. And then there's the, you know, sort of the sultry mystery, right? It's like Havana and Guantanamo and, you know, all of this wrapped up into it, you know, the Cuban cigars and Cuban rum and sort of the forbidden fruit, if you will. For me, I have to say, you know, in the beginning, it was sort of the intrigue of being able to do something that was truly life changing. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a game changer in sort of the history of the world. And that was appealing. And then, you know, when you get involved and you get to know the Cuban American community and then the Cubans when you go down to the island, these are people who are passionate, who are smart, who are family-oriented, who love life. They like to drink. They like to smoke. They like to dance. They like to cook.
Yeah.
They're friendly. They're welcoming. Come into my home. My home is your home. What can I do to make your visit, you know, better or more special? That's a really special thing, and I think it's really exciting. And to me, there will always be this soft spot because sort of the myth and the history of it, not that it's shattered because that all exists, but you get to know this place on a more intimate level, and it's a charming, wonderful, enchanting place with really incredible people. And that's a gift, you know, because it hasn't been open to us as Americans in the past. And to sort of go into this place where it's very unknown and you have no idea how people are going to react to you, you know, you could go in there and think Cubans are justified in saying, like, why are you coming here? And
yeah.
there's been this embargo and my family can't get milk or I can't get this or this is crazy. I mean, people were wrapped in American flags.
Yeah.
Like, driving in that motorcade, people were welcoming.
Yeah.
They were warm. And it's a testament to sort of the spirit of Cubans and Cuban Americans.
Yeah.
And how can you not love that?
Yeah.
Really.
Did you learn anything about yourself? Just in working on it and going to Cuba? And...
I can hold my rum.
Yeah.
Which I
learned. Really, Cuban rum is really
Cuban
better.
Rum
sorry,
is really amazing.
Sorry to all the American
you know, I will say this. I think for me, it was an exercise in humility at times.
Yeah.
I tend to be very rigid and sort of stuck in my ways. I have a thought and it's, you know, our way of doing this is the right way. And
yeah.
we have ethics and values and morals and we should not compromise them. And I'm not saying that we did or you should, but there's something to be said for approaching people that you disagree with, even when you really disagree with them on policy, but approaching them with respect.
Yeah.
In sitting yeah. down at the table yeah. and listening to what people have to say instead of sort of going off on
yeah.
your own sort of lecture. And compromise.
I remember after the election, we were doing a Skype session with the
I
Cubans.
I cried.
Well, you cried when what I remember is that, you know, the Cubans have every right to be pissed at us.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we've been, oh, Hillary will win.
That's and right. And they now, really went out on a limb.
And they went out on a limb, and yeah. now they're going to be screwed. And you just kind of knew Trump was going to fuck it up, which he did. Not entirely, though. I mean, he just kind of hit the pause button. And,
yeah.
But anyway, I'm kind of apologizing, you know. And I remember Alejandro said, you know, you don't have to apologize. You know, you're the first person who ever treated us as respect, first American who ever treated us with respect, treat us as equals. And that's actually when you were crying.
Yeah.
Because you would have done that too. And
yeah.
I think we also kind of knew that approach was probably not going to be
that's right.
the new administration.
And it doesn't mean you agree.
It doesn't mean you validate
or
their
you
views.
Think their
or
system
the,
of their, government
yeah,
is,
yeah, yeah.
you know, even
it's,
even
but
good.
It's a way for people and nations to
yeah.
address their differences.
You can't make progress by bullying.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
And what's the alternative, you know, like assassination or war or
yeah.
embargo? I mean,
yeah.
there was no progress.
Yeah.
And if it
we tried all three of those things.
We tried all three of those things. If it takes sitting down at a table and really trying to understand the other perspective, even if you completely disagree with it,
yeah.
And being respectful and eating some pig and
yeah.
drinking some rum,
yeah.
And that allows you to say there should be space for internet and space for cuenta propistas or
yeah.
at least the space
yeah.
to
yeah.
discuss it,
yeah.
Then I would say that that's progress. That's
yeah.
a march forward. And
yeah.
and it was a learning experience for me
yeah.
and something that I will carry forward with me.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on, Brenda.
So
thanks so much for walking us through that story and reliving those times. And
it was amazing. Thank you for
yeah.
the opportunity. I mean, you
no,
and
was...
Ricardo and Obama and Susan Rice, you know, you guys created the space
yeah.
for this.
Well,
and
Cuba attracted interesting people, you know, just
absolutely.
Like an eclectic group of people.
Yeah.
But I hope.
Yeah. With good intentions and good hearts.
And I think we'll get back there. I mean, this
too.
Trump age will be a bit of a missed opportunity, but I think, you know, and there's an inevitability
yeah.
to this, as the ballerina
is. It's hard to close the door, which
yeah.
I think is
yeah.
is the hope we all have. When
yeah.
it cracks open a little bit, it's hard to slam the door on sort of the hopes and the goodwill that
yeah.
were generated by what we did.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you, Brendette.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll have another Crooked Conversation next week where I chat with Tommy Vitor about what actually happened with the Benghazi attacks and how a series of conspiracy theories and cynical Republican politics and right-wing media helped create the environment that led to Donald Trump as the Republican nominee and ultimately the President of the United States. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.